Well, if you have your Bible tonight, turn with me to the book of Ruth, which in the way our Bibles are arranged comes immediately after the book of Judges. In the Hebrew Bible, that is not the case. In the Hebrew Bible, Ruth is buried much deeper into the Old Testament. And it, the present canon of the Hebrew Bible has it, it kicks off five books of the Old Testament referred to as the Megilloth, and they are these. So see if you note any connection between these. So it's Ruth, and then it's the Song of Songs, and then it's the book of Ecclesiastes, and then it's Lamentations, and then it's Esther. Now, part of the significance in the present canon, I get this from not my own observation, but from an Old Testament scholar of note, and I think he's probably right about this. In the older canon, it was always the Song of Songs that kicked off those five books. Song of Songs, then Ruth, then Ecclesiastes, then Lamentations, and then Esther. But they bumped Ruth forward one. And they probably did that. I'm almost certain he's right. Because Ruth struck them as reflective of the ideal woman at the close of the book of Proverbs, because that's what the five books, the Megilloth, follow, the book of Proverbs in that order. So you have Proverbs, which closes the last chapter in Proverbs, half of it is describing this ideal woman, then Ruth. So they bumped it up, they flipped it around because it seemed fitting to them. No, no, we'll put Ruth right here because she functions in many ways, even though she's not the main character in her book, she's not the main female character in the book. Naomi is, by any standard of measure. Naomi is the main character. More said about Naomi, Naomi says more. And she plays a more vital role in setting the stage for all that happens, though, of course, the book is named after Ruth because she is the one who turns out to be the great-great-grandmother of the Messiah. So, and she is the most surprising thing that happens. But let me read the opening five verses of Ruth, which we'll try to look at tonight. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man of Bethlehem of Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. And the name of his wife was Naomi. And the name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of the two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. And there was left with her two sons. Now that's an indicator of the prominence of Naomi already in this story. In the Hebrew Bible, you don't describe very many men as the husband of their wife. It tends to very much fall the other way around. Not here. Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, letting us know right from the start, Naomi's really central to this story. He died and she was left with two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her sons and her husband. I quoted this in another setting, but it was, I actually came across it for this sermon, so this was the original tension. There's a Hebrew commentator, author. He's not a Christian Hebrew commentator. He is a he's in the Jewish tradition, J.J. Schlotke. And in this series of Hebrew perspective Old Testament commentaries, Schlotke writes the commentary on Ruth. And he made this, I thought, very, very helpful and insightful comment in answering the question, why in the world would you bother writing a commentary on Ruth? Because it's such of a straightforward story. It doesn't seem to need much comment, you know. And that's there's truth to that. Right? I mean, I probably had the story of Ruth read to me for the first time or some summary of it when I was 3 or 4 years old. And I suspect I got the gist of it pretty well at that age. I got the idea of what happened with very little need of a commentary. But here's what Schlotke wrote about that idea. He said, judging from the English translation alone, or even from the text of the Hebrew, the reader may be tempted to wonder what room there is for a comment or of any elucidation. The simplicity of the style of the book of Ruth and the directness of the plot seem to leave little to the imagination. That is so if we read but do not ponder. The Bible should not be so treated. Its words must be weighed and measured. So you see exactly what he means by ponder. When you ponder something, you weigh the words carefully. You measure them specifically. And he's arguing that all the Bible is to be read that way. I'm sure he's right. I don't know exactly the best way to go about that other than some combination of these things. I mean, if you read the Bible that slowly, generally, no one would ever read through the Bible in a year, right? Which I think is a good practice. On the other hand, the danger of reading through the Bible year by year by year is sometimes you end up just reading to get your reading done. And so now you've read the Bible through the last 10 years in a row, but you haven't pondered anything that you've read for 10 years. You've just gotten it over with. And you sort of do it with this attitude. I already knew that. When in a real sense, you may not actually understand much of any of it very well, and hence have a difficult time with enabling the Bible to prove much help to you because you haven't really pondered it all that much. Dr. Daniel Block, who was here for our men's conference, he's written two different commentaries on the book of Ruth, one about 20 years ago and one very recently for two different commentary series. And in his most recent commentary, he makes the comment of the very thing that he argued with for our men when he was here a little over a month ago, namely that Ruth is one of those books like Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Kings in particular, which is really strongly rooted in the book of Deuteronomy. That is, the themes and the way of thinking about theological ideas that is central in the instruction of Israel, the first five books of Moses, he said, the most significant of those, it's like the epistles of Paul in the New Testament. Romans is probably the most prominent. He said, of the five books of Moses, the book of Deuteronomy is probably the most prominent. Most scholars would say that. And so Ruth is grounded back into that most prominent book. And it's there that you find this big picture storyline. Back to that review in the Wall Street Journal, the reviewer of David Christian's book says, you know, big history is becoming popular. People want to know the big story that explains their lives, and they hope it turns out to be meaningful. Well, that is what has kept the Bible a bestseller for generations, since there was such a thing as publication and sales. Why? Because the Bible storyline, there's no other story that makes human existence so meaningful, so significant, so hopeful, and also so realistic, and able to explain, as we'll hopefully even begin to see tonight, all the really, really hard things that go on. If you'll notice, the opening five verses of Ruth are pretty bleak. I put it, hard times for pleasant people. Hard times for pleasant people. The name Naomi means pleasant one. She's at the center of it. Hard times for pleasant people. And it is a really good thing to know that pleasant people are going to have hard times, and that those times fit into a universe where God is running the show. Ruth-like stories, or Naomi-like stories that we find tacked onto the front of the book of Ruth, some of you you've lived years of a story like that, or you've had it lived out right, really close to you. I can still remember, for whatever reason, you know, we were just before we moved to British Columbia in 1974, was out with our church basketball team guys, and one of the guys there that night was, he's a brand new graduate of Marquette University. He was an engineer there in North Chicago, Glenn Doles, and Glenn had gone to the University of Marquette University, which at that time, in those years, had been a basketball power. And so being from there, he liked to talk Marquette basketball. And so at the end of our little scrimmage game, we were shooting around, and I was about to move away. This was the last time I was going to get to play with these guys. It felt like forever because we were moving to Canada, and there was Glenn, who had just married Joy Brabenick in our church, and talking Marquette basketball, and I was leaving that all behind. Little to know that, you know, just 5 years later, I would be getting married and move back there. And they're now Glenn and Joy. They had two toddlers, little boys by that age. So got intersected with them again in the summer of 1979. Fast forward, Christmas 1979. Joy and Glenn are Christmas shopping when somebody just runs out of control head on into them in one of the malls in suburban Chicago, and the hood of that other car detached itself. They hit so hard the hood detached itself and came through the windshield and hit Glenn in the forehead. Now, for about 48 hours, it looked great. It looks like, oh, yeah, Glenn's, you know, they're nervous, but Glenn's talking. Glenn is, he's looking good, you know, they're, you know, but pray, because the doctors seem nervous, even though he's doing so good. And then over about an eight-hour period, they found out why the doctors were so nervous, because his brain just suddenly swelled, and he was gone. He was gone. What's God doing? A scenario like that. Joy never remarried. She had a sister die way too early in life. She raised those two toddlers by herself. She's about 70 years old now. She did that all on her own, whole life. Christmas shopping, wham. I've shared before, when I moved out to Iowa, there was a couple in our church. They were never able to have children, and they both really, really, really loved children. Oscar and Linnea Peterson. His nickname was Oki, and they were tremendously kind to myself and our family as we added children and so forth. And Linnea had a brother named Gordon Larson, and Gordon hadn't gone to church in years, and Linnea had an idea. Why don't you go over and see my brother Gordon and invite him to church? And so I thought, sure, I'll try that. And Gordon lived on one of these places. It's a lot like, if you've ever been out to John and Carla Brown's place, you know, it's like it sits right in the middle of a section. So it's almost fully, the driveway's about a half mile long. Only in Gordon's place, it's uphill. So it's a little uphill, and so his house sits about a half mile off of the gravel road, but up on a hill, and then the buildings were behind that. And I drove up there and, you know, knocked on the door and commented to him. I said, wow, you got quite a driveway there. Yeah, he said, the wonderful thing about that driveway is it gives you about a minute and a half to decide whether you're going to be home or not. He says, you get to see who's coming, and you just get to make a decision. And that particular night, Gordon, I knew nothing about him. Linnea told me nothing. I went there, and he sat me down, and then he went into the kitchen to make Coca-Cola shakes for us. I'd never, our Coca-Cola, like a float, Coca-Cola float. And while he was gone, I was looking at these family pictures, and Gordon's wife, we grew up really, as kids, the big thing was to watch Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan movies. And the woman who played Jane across from him in most of those was Maureen O'Hara, and she was, you know, a very striking movie star. Gordon's wife looked, she reminded me of that movie star. And he came out, and I asked him about the picture and about his wife, and he moved me out to the picture window and said, yeah, you know, just down the road, right down there a ways. He said, my wife was coming home from work, and she flipped our pickup truck in the ditch. And she got a brain injury. He said, we took extreme measures. He said, I don't know what, you know, if you, you know, you just do what you do. He said, so then for the next 5 years, said she was in a nursing home. She could never come home. He said, you know, she never, her eyes would open. He said, there'd never be a tear in them. There would never be any recognition that you were there. He said, but for 5 years, I went to that home every night. And then I would read the paper to her. I would read this and that to her. And then I would sit there and I would just do that until 10 o'clock. And then I'd go home. And then the next night I'd do the same thing. He goes, you know, for a couple months, people are sort of, they come around and they remember that you're doing that, and then everybody forgets. And then it's just you. Then it's just you. And then eventually she died. And then he said to me, you think God has anything to do with something like that? Do you think God has anything to do with something like that? And being a 20-some-year-old Calvinist, I said, oh, yeah, I think he has everything to do with it. I don't know exactly what he's doing, but I think he has everything to do with it. He wasn't expecting that answer. He was expecting for me to try to get God off the hook somehow. So he didn't quite know what to do, and we talked about that for a little while longer, and then he changed the subject and went on to something else. And the next time I saw Linnea, she said, how do you think that visit went? And I didn't know. I didn't know how I thought it went. I said, I don't know. I mean, he was certainly nice, but And lo and behold, then he started coming to our church with some regularity. Himself survived a brain aneurysm, surprised all of the medical people down in Sioux City when he survived it. But I tell you those two stories because they're the kind of personal stories that you know, stories like that around you. And like I say, some of you, that you have that story. That's part of your own story. See, Ruth is that kind of story. That's what's going on here. And in this opening section, we get a 10-year-long window of that story. I can tell you, when I was sitting there in that farmhouse on that evening, When he told me about going and reading to his wife without any feedback from her every single night for 5 years, the terms for better for worse in your marriage vows became pretty striking. Like, whew, wow. Wow. 5 years is a long time to do that. Well, in these five verses, you see that? We read five verses. Well, there's the opening five verses of Ruth. But in there, it's the mention that, you know, this little scenario of disaster that I've just described for you, it lasted 10 years. Now, if you ponder that, it'll cause you to shudder. Does God do things like this to his people? Painful, disturbing things that might go on painfully and disturbingly for 10 years. He sure does. He sure does. It's right here in the text of his words to us. It's right here, staring up at you off the page of the book of Ruth. My sub-points this morning are all stolen from... quasi-stolen from Charles Dickens. I don't know if any of you, how many ever read Charles Dickens' book, Tale of Two Cities? Tale of Two Cities, see? There we go, Tale of Two Cities, quite a few. One of the more famous opening lines in all of Dickens' literature. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Well, in these opening five verses, you don't need the first little phrase. There's nothing the best of times here. It's just the worst of times repeated over and over again. So the worst of times, stage one. The worst of times, stage one. That would be the opening verse. In the days of the judges, when they ruled there, there was a famine in the land. And a man from Bethlehem of Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. He and his wife and two sons. It was the worst of times. Now, it's the worst of times just sociologically. That's what you're told right off the bat. This is in the days of the judges. Oh, well, what's going on in the days of the judges? Well, we know the end of the book of Judges. See, now, again, this is your canonical consciousness. If you remember, how does the book of Judges end? Because it ends to sort of give you a picture of a time period. So where does the sociological life of Israel, how is it to be left ringing in your ears in the book of Judges? Well, this way, things have gotten worse than Sodom and Gomorrah. The author of Judges closes the last three or four chapters of Judges. He paints a Sodom and Gomorrah-like picture of an Israelite town that is demonstrably notched up as a little more shocking and worse than what's going on in Sodom and Gomorrah when the Lord destroys it there in the book of Genesis. And in our location in the canon, you see, because of this comment, Ruth is located right at the close of the book of Judges. So right after these complete disaster scenarios are spun out at the end of the book of Judges, next book is Ruth. And Ruth opens by telling you, this story is rooted in the days of the judges, which you just read. You just finished reading this shocking account of how disastrously everything has gone there. Now, this raises the whole issue, and again, you know, just think about this. You know, these are things that you're supposed to ponder as you go along here. Does God control weather patterns? You know, we see our weather coming at us from 3 or 4 days out, and sometimes the weather forecast that's even a week long seems really, really accurate. So our weather patterns seem pretty scientifically explainable. I don't know. I mean, haven't we gone beyond the place where we really need to have any mention of God in the as relates to the weather? Doesn't the weather simply sort of run on its own, just simply by accident and chance? Well, not in the Bible it doesn't. Not in the Bible it doesn't. In fact, you know, we've argued the narrative world of Ruth is rooted back in the narrative world of the book of Deuteronomy. So if you have your Bible, just drop with me back to Deuteronomy 28. We'll look at verses 23 and 24. And I'm just telling you right now, whether you believe it or not, as the author writes Ruth, this is the sort of thing that's supposed to jump to your mind as soon as you read, number one, it's the days of the book of the judges, and there's a famine. And there's a famine. Well, what could possibly be the connection between the days of the book of the Judges and the famine? Well, here it is, Deuteronomy 28, 23, and 24, in this long section where the curses of unbelief and disobedience are being laid out, warnings to the people of God. And the heavens over your head shall be bronze, and the earth under you shall be iron. The Lord will make the rain of your land powder. From heaven dust shall come down on you until you are destroyed. That's simply a picture of the land in famine. No rain comes, nothing grows, dust blows around. There you have it. There you have it. And if you know anything about the book of Judges, you're not surprised that this might have happened in that environment. I don't know if different ages, these different Disney movies come out. Any of you, your children, or watch the Disney movie Aladdin? Aladdin. Okay, got a few. For a little while, that was one of the favorite movies for our children, which means they want to watch it over and over and over again and see whether they can just fry their brains out on the same movie. But there's a little scene in an Aladdin when the evil sorcerer Jafar, he's always got this parrot on his shoulder that travels with him everywhere, and the great mythology that they're working with is that eventually a peasant will come along and they'll be able to go out and seize this particular item, but anybody else that swallows it. Anybody else that tries it, the ground will swallow them down, right? So that's the scenario. And so he finds this really gifted thief, and he sends him off to try, to grab the item, and they're watching, and he runs over, and then you get to see him, and then suddenly the earth swallows him down. And the sorcerer Jafar says very solemnly, "I guess he was not worthy." And those of you who have seen it, you remember. So now the parrot, Iago, on his shoulder lifts his wing up and goes like this. Now there's a big surprise. I think I'm going to die at that surprise, that he wasn't worthy. Right? Well, that's what you're supposed to do here. These are the days of the book of Judges. There was a famine in the land. There's a big surprise. That's exactly what God said he would do. There's a famine in the land. Of course there's a famine in the land. Yes. Yes. These are the days in which you would expect God's judgment to fall. And it's fallen. Back in 2004, there was a article in the Wall Street Journal. Remember what happened in December 2004. I didn't actually watch the news that day. I learned of this in the middle of our worship service. Our own worship leader, Mr. Jim Clausen, he from the stage he announced that a tsunami wave had just swept into the coast of Southeast Asia. And they were expecting the death toll to easily run into the tens of thousands, and initially they didn't know whether it would run into the hundreds of thousands. Well, a specialty piece by an Orthodox theologian by the name, and I'm Orthodox in the Russian Orthodox use of the word, David Hart, who is a regular contributor over the years to the Wall Street Journal, he wrote a specialty piece in the journal on the 31st of January that year, excuse me, 31st of December that year, and said, "Let's not have any of this nonsense about God having any part in that sort of thing. So let's just get that on the table. Nobody had better say that." If God once in a while, or even with some regularity, has his hand on weather systems, he didn't have his hand on that one. Well, you can see, right, why you would very much be tempted to say that. But you can't say it. He referred to anybody who would say that as uttering, quote, odious banalities. Odious banalities. However, again, in the narrative world of the Bible, is there any possibility for a completely random, un-God-related storm anywhere doing anything? Is there? If you have your Bible again, just look. This is a poetic passage, but it's Psalm 135. 135. Verses 6 and 7. I don't know how many times I had read the Psalms through a number, and certainly I just don't know how many times. But on Christmas night in 1987, there I was reading, I've mentioned this before, I got John Piper's book, Desiring God for Christmas, and I'm reading introduction, and John Piper is pontificating on the notion that what's the chief end of man? Man's chief end is to glorify God by enjoying him forever, and the sovereignty of God is key to what the what our joy is rooted into. So we should always take great pleasure in the complete sovereignty of God. And he quoted two texts from the Psalms that make basically this bold statement. I'm using the second of the two. Psalm 135, 6. Whatever the Lord pleases, he does. In heaven and on earth, in the seas and all deeps. Whatever God pleases, he does. So if it happens in heaven, God related to it. Happens on earth, God's related to it. Happens in the sea, God's related to it. Verse 7, he it is who makes the clouds to rise at the end of the earth, who makes lightnings for rain and brings forth the wind from his storehouses. So, in this opening section of Ruth, this is the table that's being laid down by just these little comments that are made as we go. There's famine in the land. This is the time of the book of Judges. There's famine in the land, and therefore, it's the worst of times. But it's not the worst of times because God is having a bad game. He's struggling. The Lord was in a slump that year. That's not it. That happens to baseball players with some regularity. It never happens to the Lord. He never slumps. He never finds it hard to keep up with what he's in charge of. He's never having an off year as being God. And so we know in these, the worst of times, when you're reading this, we are to be confident. God is doing things here. God is doing things here. God's overseeing the time of the judges. God is overseeing. He's responding to it to get their attention through this famine. that's been sent. In fact, as he sends the famine, he simply shows himself to be faithful to his words because he said he would send famine. Now, we're already out of time, and we're just in the first of these four or five worst of time statements. So we're going to have to come back and pick this up. But just as we close, just think about these questions. What does somebody like David Hart think a more satisfying response to God's involvement is to life and what happens in it? Because really, really difficult things happen in it. Awful things happen in it. Some of you have been involved in the Among Foundation for many, many years. One of the guys, there's several, to show you what a consistent board it's been in many ways. I think I'm the fourth longest serving person on that board, and I'm at 24 years this year. So three people on it are longer than 24 years, and one of those is Randy Raeling, and Randy this last year has been just my wife and his wife had exactly the same symptoms at pretty much exactly the same time a little over a year ago. It's called drop foot. You notice you're out taking a walk, and all of a sudden you notice your foot is just kind of slapping. You're just kind of slapping the sidewalk, and it doesn't feel right. And you don't know exactly what to do about it. And Shirley went, to her doctor in one direction, and Randy went with his wife Karen in another direction, And Shirley was told, I think you might have a muscle problem of some kind here. And she went off to our own Jay Idesness, and he was her therapist, and he worked on that problem, and she's gone. And Randy and Karen went off to the Mayo Clinic, and they just 10 days ago came back with their decisive now diagnosis. It's ALS. You're traveling and things that you think you'd really like to do, we recommend that you get to them this summer, because this will probably be the last summer that anything like that is a serious possibility. That's a sober piece of news. 60 years old. Likely be dead in a couple of years. With a really painful path to get there. Really painful path to get there. Is God involved in that? You see, in the narrative world that we just, this story in Ruth, the answer is, of course he is. He couldn't not be. Our alternatives are to say, no, just bad luck and chance. It's the random genes. Those random genes, the Lord can't be keeping track of all the genes. He's those random genes. And somehow, we think that that's more comforting. He has nothing to do with these really painful things. When in fact, see, this story is teaching you, he has everything to do with them. And more than that, as we'll see as we move forward, and he may be weaving incredible blessing into these initially overwhelmingly painful realities. He's done it before. In fact, he does it all the time. In fact, if you belong to him, he promises he's doing it in your case. That all things really do work together for good to those who love God and were called according to his purpose. Now, if you say that lightly and glibly, and then it's sort of a cruel. But if you say it with the background of the narrative world of Ruth, where very painful things last 10 years, and where the story clearly illustrates that principle, that promise. It's going to be carried out here in spades. Though Naomi's really suffering along the way. But we'll come back and pick her up in July. A couple of missionaries, a potluck, and then we'll be back. Let's close. We'll look to the Lord in prayer. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for the opportunity that we have to think about our lives in the light of you, in the light of your warnings and promises, but particularly as your people who know you in and through Christ, in your gloriously hopeful promises, that though our lives may have dauntingly painful aspects to them, you are sure to work these together for our good, our eternal good. We thank you for it in Jesus' name.